This is a Public Affair on KGNU Community Radio. I'm Hannah Lee Myers. These days, you usually hear me hosting the Cannabis Report segment on The Morning Magazine with Leland Rucker, the first and third Thursdays of every month. And over the last year on the Cannabis Report and on other KGNU news programming, we've been doing our best to keep listeners up to speed with the ever-changing legal landscape for plant medicines and psychedelics in Colorado. Today, we bring you a program that will hopefully shed some light on questions you may have surrounding the present and future of psychedelics and other plant medicines in the state since the passage of Proposition 122 last November. Before we get into it, a few notes for our listeners. We will be spending the next near half hour talking about drugs and drug activity. And the goal here is education and increased understanding of the law. To be clear, KGNU does not support illegal drug activity or risky drug activity. Trigger warning for our listeners as well. We do discuss abuse in this program. And finally, we also want to make clear that although you will be hearing from a well-informed lawyer this morning, the information you hear on a public affair today is not legal advice. That said, to guide us through this conversation, as our host, we have journalist Douglas Brown. Among other things, Douglas was the Washington bureau chief for two leading technology magazines, wrote about food for the Denver Post for a decade, helped launch several blogs, including the Mountain West's first blog dedicated to beer and spirits, as well as published and wrote a book about sex that landed him multiple appearances on the Today Show, a movie deal, and lots of time on TV and radio. After leaving the newspaper and magazine world, Douglas became involved in the cannabis industry, mostly in the realm of personal relations. He's also a longtime advocate for plant medicine and psychedelics. And Douglas, we thank you so much for hosting our conversation this morning. Take it away.
Thank you so much. Today on the show, we have Barina Maevska. She's an attorney at the Denver law firm Vicente Cederberg, and she was quite involved with Proposition 122, the referendum in November that legalized certain kinds of psychedelic plant compounds. Barina, welcome to KGNU.
Hey, Douglas. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So why and how did you become so involved with Proposition 122?
Well, I think to answer that, Vicente Cederberg and Josh Kappel, who's a founding partner of Vicente Cederberg and my co-chair of our Emerging Therapies and Entheogens Practice Group, he really wrote a lot of the language in cooperation with other folks involved in that. But I think to answer your question, I got to go back and say that yeah, I think psychedelics really saved my life, to put it very plainly. I've had a long relationship with plant medicine that started fairly young, and it's what put me on my spiritual path and really opened my eyes to different kinds of non-conceptual reality. So I was a lawyer at one point earlier on, and I actually thought about leaving the law to go study plant medicine more in depth. I was a research assistant at Johns Hopkins University on their psilocybin mushroom studies. And eventually, due to life circumstances, I ended up not pursuing that route and coming back to law and joining Vicente Cederberg, where I was doing a lot of cannabis-related law, including IP and things like that. And the firm and I really share a similar activist spirit and a passion for plant medicine and its importance in this culture especially. So, you know, as that became more of a reality nationwide, we opened a psychedelic-focused practice group, and Josh and I lead that together. So that's sort of how I came around to this part of the landscape.
That's so interesting. And now, as a result of a lot of advocacy, you were involved with the advocacy for Proposition 122, a range of psychedelic plant compounds are now legal in Colorado. And so how can Coloradans today participate in this new legal psychedelic landscape?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the best way to answer that is that Prop 122 passed two sort of prongs, and one is a regulated access prong, where people can access certain plant medicine, certain natural medicines, that's defined in Prop 122, through a regulated access model, much like Oregon's, and I'll say more about that. And then it also passed sort of a personal use prong that we've been referring to as just the personal use prong, and that's the unregulated access, where people can, for their own personal use, and we can talk more about what that means, use sort of a different set of these medicines than what's allowed under the regulated access model. So to answer your question, under the regulated access model, no one can do anything yet. There's an advisory board. that will be advising DORA, the state regulatory agency, about how this will all unfold in Colorado. Board applications were put in at the end of December. They will announce who's on the board. It's a 15-person board at the end of January. And then, you know, very slowly that regulatory, it's actually not very slow for that type of process, but, you know, slowly that regulatory process will unfold. But essentially, the date is September 1st, 2024, before applications for healing center licenses will start to be accepted. So under the regulated access model, there will be licensed healing centers, permitted facilities, licensed facilitators, and a system by which people can go get medicine for use in these contexts. And so none of that is available yet. It's all in the works. It's a several-year rollout. And also important to note that under the regulated access prong, it's only psilocybin and psilocin that are permitted. So none of the other medicines that are covered in Prop 122 are covered under the regulated access prong.
I see. So, but today people can engage with personal use, is that right?
That's correct.
And how can, if I want to engage in this, in personal use of psilocybin, how can I go about doing that?
So first you'd have to make sure you're talking about, if it's psilocybin, it's fine. You'd have to talk about one of the natural medicines that was covered under personal use, right? So that's ibogaine, the active ingredient in iboga, DMT, one of the active ingredients, the only controlled substance in ayahuasca, typically, psilocybin, psilocin. Did I say them all? Might be missing one.
Mescaline,
thank you, but not including peyote for other reasons that we can get into. So you'd have to make sure you're engaging in one of those medicines. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have to read the Act, Natural Medicine Health Act, sort of carefully to make sure that you're operating within its confines.
Interesting. So I presume that prior to November, it was illegal for me to, for example, grow psilocybin mushrooms. It is now legal for me to do that. Is that correct?
It is legal as long as you're complying with the rest of the personal use provisions. So, for example, one thing that is interesting, there's rumblings, right? Like people voted this in. It passed by 54%. You know, it passed pretty squarely, passed easily, in my opinion. But, you know, you hear things that people think that this legalized sales. And it did not legalize sales, not even under the regulated access provision. It never legalized sales for off-site use. So under neither personal use nor regulated access did Prop 122 legalize the sale of these medicines. So it does legalize in some cases under the personal use section, cultivation, growing mushrooms for your own personal use. Mm-hmm. Again, you have to be within the limits, right? For example, you have to be 21 or over. Mm-hmm. Where you're growing it cannot be accessible by people under 21. So you can't grow it somewhere without building in protections to keep children away from it. You cannot grow more than what's a personal use amount. And I say that in quotes because a personal use amount is not quantitatively defined in the act, but rather it's the amount that is reasonable for personal use, whatever that means, plus a reasonable amount to share in these very specifically permitted contexts. So the short answer is yes, you might be able to cultivate psilocybin. You'd have to do it while complying with the rest of the personal use provisions.
The sharing aspect I find very interesting. Predating COVID and up until today, I encounter a lot of people who talk about people are organizing a psilocybin event. And so they're saying, you come to our venue, often it's a private home, and maybe it's limited to 10 or 12 people. And it might cost $200 or something, but they're saying you show up, we have delicious food for you, we have live music, we have people there who are sober to take care of you. Meanwhile, you're going to do mushrooms, you're going to do psilocybin, and we're not selling the psilocybin, that's just, you know, we're just sharing them with you. Mm-hmm. Is that legal?
It might be. I think it's going to be a very fact-intensive inquiry. And I think, you know, not to sort of jump the gun, but I do think we're going to have bad actors trying to operate outside the confines of personal use, which could put the whole personal use section at risk. So it feels really important to me to kind of outline, you know, like what we're talking about here in terms of what's permitted and what's not. So it's great that they're starting by saying we're not selling the psilocybin. That's good, right? Sales are never allowed. If someone can attend the ceremony and pay $50 if they're not going to do the psilocybin, but it's $200 if they are attending the ceremony and they want to be gifted the psilocybin, it sure starts to look a lot like they're selling the mushrooms, even if they say they're not, right? So that's the kind of fact-intensive inquiry. Obviously, all participants would have to be 21 or older. And then this is where it kind of gets more nuanced, because personal use doesn't permit sale. It also doesn't permit commercial activity, right? So then you get into the question of what's commercial activity. And again, this is the part of the personal use prong, that's not all black and white, right? I think we're going to really see scenarios coming up where people are going to be trying to use the personal use prong in a way that wasn't intended. And so we're going to have to see people, we're going to have to see courts and how legislation reacts to how people are using this. One bright line rule is that if there's paid advertising, it's presumed to be commercial activity. So if they've got Facebook ads all over the place about their psilocybin circles, paid advertising, commercial activity, you're not in personal use anymore. Your giving away of the psilocybin is illegal. You've just kicked yourself all the way out of Prop 122. You can't give away natural medicine as part of a business promotion. So like if this is a launch of my new book and to celebrate my new book and hope that you buy many copies of my book, come on over and you'll get the book and you'll get, you know, 2 grams of mushrooms. Probably business promotion, therefore commercial activity. You're not in personal use anymore. Now your psilocybin circle is illegal again.
Interesting. One thing that interests me are liability issues. Now that this is legal, if I were the host and somebody had a bad trip and it was traumatic for them, would they be able to sue me with some expectation that they might actually win?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's an area of law that I'm very personally interested in and have been doing a lot of work on. Again, we're not sure, right? So if you were the facilitator of a psilocybin circle, you'd want to make sure you're complying with all the nuanced pieces of the personal use prong. And someone facilitating that kind of ceremony could definitely have civil liability, possibly also criminal, but let's talk about civil first because I think that's an easier analysis. Even if they were operating within the confines of personal use, the question would be, like in any sort of tort case, in any sort of civil liability for personal injury, it would be, you know, what are your damages and was the facilitator negligent in some way in the performance of a duty they owed you, right? So a lot of what personal use protects is, for example, bona fide harm reduction services or bona fide spiritual guidance. So if they're operating within personal use, they have to be doing one of these types of things, you know, therapeutic, counseling, spiritual growth, life coaching, harm reduction, something like that. So as soon as someone's offering that kind of a service, there is some duty of care they have to the participants, right? Just as in if someone came to your house as a plumber and was providing a plumbing service, they would have a certain duty of care to not flood your kitchen, let's say. So there is going to be some duty of care, and that's going to be established over time by case law. And then the question would be, if you had a really, really bad trip, did they breach that duty of care to you? Were they negligent in their performance of these services for you? Right. And again, that's going to be incredibly fact specific. And there is no real legal precedent. You know, psychedelics have not been legal, right? So we don't have US case law where we can point to. But I imagine we'll be able to borrow some. Like one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is bartender laws, right? You can't keep serving someone alcohol after they're really inebriated and then send them out to drive home, right? The bartender's going to have liability. The bar is going to have liability as their employer. I would imagine that it would be reasonable for something very parallel to that to develop. So if I'm hosting a psilocybin ceremony, I can't just keep dosing you all night, hoping you have an awesome breakthrough experience. And by the end of it, you're just a mess and it's been way more than you can handle. Or bring in someone who's never done psychedelics before, give them a heroic dose of mushrooms, right? All of these are very likely to be considered a breach of that duty of care, are likely to be negligence in the performance of those services. So absolutely, there's possibility for civil liability. And I'll add one other thing because I think it's interesting. One of the things that personal use does not protect is malpractice. So if you're a therapist and you're operating within the personal use provisions, you know, as best we understand them as they're playing out right now. So you're providing bona fide therapy, but then you, in providing that bona fide therapy, you do something that's so crappy in how you're providing that therapy that it would be considered malpractice. You've now not only opened yourself up to civil liability, you have kicked yourself out of the protections of the personal use prong. So now you've almost definitely got criminal liability too, because now you're providing, gifting a controlled substance that's not protected under personal use anymore, because personal use does not protect malpractice.
One thing that strikes me in addition is, and then the personal use regime, again, if we're talking about these sort of gatherings, is it presumed that they're going to grow their own, if indeed that they're doing it legally, that because you can't buy it? So
right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's all sorts of arrangements possible. I've heard of all sorts of arrangements being proposed by different folks. The facilitators might grow their own. Growing mushrooms is not like baking cookies. You know, there's a few steps that can go wrong. It's also not like, you know, chemists trying to synthesize LSD. It's simpler than that and harder than baking cookies. But it doesn't have to be that way, right? It could be that, like, they have a friend and their friend just gifts the mushrooms and the facilitators just facilitate the ceremony and provide good music and support and harm reduction and integration afterwards, hopefully. Yeah, I really hope that most of these people are providing integration after. But where the mushrooms come from is not a necessarily spelled out thing. As long as no one's selling them, no one under 21 is around when they're being cultivated, all of those kinds of things. If you're complying with those provisions, there's no reason to say, and then a completely unrelated third party buddy of ours is going to be gifting the mushrooms for the ceremony, partake or not if you like, for example. But then again, there's another avenue of civil liability there, kind of for whoever's providing the mushrooms. There might be products liability for mushrooms. There are some bad products being sold online, for example, where psilocybin is being combined with an MAO inhibitor. So an MAO inhibitor will essentially briefly slow down the breakdown of serotonin. So you'll end up with a much longer and a much stronger trip than if you took just the same amount of mushrooms without the MAO inhibitor. But now some people are selling it completely illegally separately, like no sales of psilocybin online or in dispensaries or anything is legal anywhere in the U.S. But in that, they're mixing up interesting chemicals and creating effects that people are not educated about. Oftentimes, the facilitators are not educated about.
Yeah, you mentioned the online sales, and I get a lot of ads served to me, especially on Instagram, for like branded psilocybin products, like chocolate bars. It sounds like those are illegal. If I buy one of those online, could I be charged with a crime?
Yeah, I think you absolutely could. I mean, you are buying a controlled substance, even with the state law, right? Like, it's like early cannabis law. Like, none of this is federally legal. So every time you engage in any sort of buying or selling or anything, well, buying or selling, you're breaking state law too, but you're definitely breaking federal law, right? So you're trafficking in a controlled substance. So absolutely.
Even though we can't participate today in the regulated market, there are things about it that interest me quite a bit. I have a friend who builds educational platforms. And so she's developing educational platforms that she hopes will help these future sort of psychedelic therapists go about what they do ethically, responsibly, and just, you know, properly. And one of her concerns is you're going to have these situations where you're going to have let's say a therapist who is presumably sober and a person who is, you know, having some kind of psychedelic experience, which can be incapacitating, which is an invitation, she thinks, for abuse. And is this something that has come up much in conversations around legalizing these substances?
Yeah, totally. And it's a subject that I'm personally really passionate about because I've seen it go wrong so often in the underground market, you know, where people aren't trying to operate legally, but you hear through word of mouth and stuff some of the things that are happening. And I think those are likely to just continue happening and grow even more egregious as we come into a legal market in some ways, regulated access or personal use. I think anytime you have someone trip sitting, doing harm reduction services, spiritual guidance, ayahuasca circles, more religious use, anything where someone is holding the container for someone else to be engaging in psychedelics, there's a huge potential for abuse. And I think I'm really glad people like your friend exist, because I think at VS, one of the things we talk a lot about is how we can, in parallel to this legalization move, how we can support public education so people, consumers, are incredibly informed about what's good therapy, you know, what's a good container, what are good harm reduction services, and what's absolutely bad and not acceptable and creates all sorts of bad power dynamics. And I think as a community, those ethical standards have not been standardized, and people are coming to this from all sorts of different contexts, you know, appropriate contexts, religious use, therapeutic use, spiritual growth. They all have different frames under which someone would take the medicine and someone would sit for them. They all look different. And I think that's fine and beautiful. And like, you know, some of the some of the reason for moving forward something like Prop 122 so folks have those options. But I do think in all of those contexts, there's good behavior and ethical behavior, and there's bad behavior and unethical behavior. And I think figuring out as a community what falls under those buckets and really making that a very loud part of the conversation is the only way to prevent bad outcomes here.
I understand that we're still, it's a ways out before there's going to be a regulated market in which we can participate. But do we have any idea at this point what the sort of facilitators might look like? Is it limited to, let's say, existing psychotherapists who then presumably go on and get some additional training in psychedelic therapy? Could I, a journalist, decide I want to be a psychedelic therapist and go and get some kind of certification and go off and do it?
Yeah, it's a question that folks in Oregon, you know, with what they've passed, are wrestling with now in their implementation stage. And it's definitely something we've talked about a lot in Colorado. The idea is that we're going to have some sort of tiered training thing that hasn't been built yet. But, you know, between DORA and this advisory board, and the advisory board is sort of intentionally selected to represent different aspects of this community. So it's definitely not the idea that it's only going to be, you know, PhDs in psychology, clinical psych practitioners who have 10 years of experience, because there's all sorts of traditional indigenous religious use that doesn't fit sort of our Western educational model that's very valid and very beneficial use. So the idea with regulated access is not to exclude all of that, but to create some sort of tiered training program where you can be a facilitator of one degree or another, and we'll acknowledge that some people have more of the kind of experience that we care about than others. But what exactly that will look like is unknown. It's very unlikely that you as a journalist or me as a lawyer, if we had no other experience, could just come in and be a licensed facilitator.
Yeah.
But it also may not be prohibitive in the sense that there may be a relatively simple training program where you could become some sort of apprentice facilitator or a beginner facilitator or something who only works under support. I'm riffing on all of this stuff. It's just sort of how I guess it'll play out. But it hasn't been built yet. That's what the board and DORA is going to be doing.
Right. So one thing that does interest me about this, and I'm eager for your answer, is in the regulated market, if I engage with, let's say, a psychedelic therapist, am I going to be limited to experiencing the psychedelic trip in the company of the therapist, or can I buy it from the therapist, receive some counseling, take it home and do it?
It would always be with a licensed facilitator, and it would have to be in some sort of approved facility that may actually end up including residential places, nursing homes and stuff. I'm not sure exactly how that would play out, but it would be places that the state has considered, the regulatory body has considered under advisement of the board as appropriate places to conduct this kind of activity. So it's not, you can't go to a facilitator, buy the mushrooms, and run to Red Rocks for a concert under the regulated access.
And will the facilitators be able to work with more than one patient at a time, or will it typically be one person taking the psychedelic and one therapist?
I suspect it would be one-on-one, but I might be wrong about that. That's a detail I don't actually know.
And the reason I ask that is I've seen a therapist a number of times. She's awesome, and she's $150 an hour, and she's worth every dime. But psychedelic experiences can be 4-6 more hours. And if we're looking at, let's even say $100 an hour, all of a sudden your psychedelic trip might cost you $600 or $800, not including the cost of the mushrooms. That sounds like it might end up being a kind of experience just for wealthy people.
Yeah, again, you're hitting on a question I feel really passionately about. We've had conversations at VS around equitable access. There are folks like Alchemy out in California doing amazing things with providing very low-cost ketamine treatment to different underserved populations right now, and we're just going to have to build that in. I don't know how that'll play out in the regulated access model, but there will have to be ways for lower-cost access to these medicines. I think that's absolutely crucial. One last thing I'd like to clarify as we wrap up is that we at VS, and I personally, have a lot of faith that the Colorado state legislation will respect what the voters voted in, and will just sort of keep it as is. But that's not guaranteed, right? So if we really screw up, if folks really screw up on the personal use prong, there's a chance that that whole prong could get rolled back or limited or eliminated entirely. And I don't think that will be the case. But it's also really good motivation for people not to just go wild right now. Like, we've legalized everything. It's the 70s. Let's go party, right? Like, there's very good incentive for that not to happen and for people to go really read and understand the nuances of the personal use prong and ask for help if they don't understand it before they start trying to operate under its provisions. Because I think if we have really bad case scenarios, it really can be rolled back. And our hope is that it won't. And the state legislation will just let what the voters voted in stand.
Great advice. Barina Majewska, thank you so much for your time. That was such a rich trove of information and guidance. This is A Public Affair. I am Douglas Brown. Thank you.